The Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area covers the northeast quarter of the state and includes sites that can help visitors understand the story of American agriculture. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When the Silos and Smokestacks idea emerged in 1991, it came out of the idea that Iowa is home to some beautiful sites and fascinating stories that are often overlooked. When it became a national heritage area in 1996, the stories really began to be told. Today, we'll talk about the National Heritage Area and four new sites that are now a part of it. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The idea for Silos and Smokestacks emerged in 1991. The Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area was founded in 1996. It's one of 49 national heritage areas in the United States, managed by the National Park Service. It covers 37 counties in the northeastern quarter of the state, bordered roughly by Interstates 80 and 35. It includes 110 different sites. And today we'll talk about the National Heritage Area. We're also going to get to know four of the new sites that are now a part of it. With me now is Candy Welch Street. She is Program and Partnership Director of Silos and Smokestacks in Waterloo. Hello, Candy.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about the heritage area.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I think there are people who drive past those signs on Interstate 80 or 35 and other parts of the state that see the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area and think, what? So let's start with that. Can you describe for people who aren't familiar with this what this National Heritage Area is about?
You bet. My family has the same response. And you know, really, those signs are an indicator that say this part of the state of Iowa is a special place that Congress and the National Park Service have recognized for its special contributions to the American experience. A little bit different than a national park unit where they can fence in that region and capture it in a moment in time and preserve it. The Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area is a special region where the story of American agriculture has been nationally and internationally significant here in those 37 counties. And it continues to play a big role in agriculture in our nation and world. And so when you see those signs, you should feel proud as an Iowan that you live in a special place that has been recognized by the United States as a place that should be preserved to share their agricultural heritage.
And when you say agricultural heritage, there are sites within the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area that, when a lot of us think about agricultural heritage, we think about farms and rural sites. But this is not just about farms.
Right. Really, the heritage area is made up of farms. It's made up of museums, historical sites, vineyards, even ag industrial sites. Each one of those places are telling a thread of the story. Obviously, the story of agriculture is very complex, and no one site could tell that story. Not even Living History Farms in Des Moines, which happens to be a partner site, could tell the whole story. But together, you weave a quilt, if you will, of stories. And so collectively, we're building and telling that story. We got a long ways to go, but the four sites we're going to be talking to today are definitely exciting new additions to the heritage area.
It is such a large area. Like I said, 37 counties. It covers really more than a quarter of the state of Iowa. Why this particular area? There are many other historic sites in other parts of Iowa as well.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very common question, a good question. Really, it started out because in Waterloo, particularly, and the Cedar Valley here, there were folks that were concerned about their heritage, and actually after the farm crisis, they were concerned about the deterioration of their downtown. And so they kind of stumbled into becoming a national heritage area. They found that their agricultural and industrial heritage was really quite significant beyond what, you know, their everyday lives had imagined, and that others outside the region would be interested in knowing more about it. And so they started on a process of looking into what could they do to preserve their downtown, but they also at the same time looked into how could they preserve their agricultural industrial heritage. And, you know, several years later, they became a national heritage area. It's always amazing the power of a few individuals, what they can accomplish. And it makes me really proud to be, you know, an Iowan myself, and to see the work they've done. But the heritage area then grew. You can't look at the urban story without looking at the rural story. And so quickly that story spread, or that region spread into 37, it went into 17 counties and then 37 counties. And once you get congressional leaders involved, it quickly can expand, as you might imagine. But more importantly, we wanted to reach out to the Living History Farms area. They were nationally significant. So were the Amana colonies south by Interstate 80. And so that region grew. Could the whole state of Iowa be recognized? You betcha. But right now, the congressional designation has been just for those 37 counties.
So as you have worked to put together these sites, and as we'll talk about in just a moment, are incorporating new sites into the area, how do you see people from around the country turning to this information?
Well, are you asking?
For example, if somebody hears about the Silos and Smokestacks mm-hmm. National Heritage Area and they think, oh, well, that would be fun to really explore agricultural history in Iowa, how do you see them coming to your site and planning a trip, perhaps?
Oh, you betcha. Actually, the fastest and easiest way is to go to the website at www.silosandsmokestacks.org. We have trip planning materials on the website. We also are very aware that travelers to our region pick up information still today. Heritage travelers pick up information while they're in visitor and welcome centers and at their hotel stays. So we have visitor guides throughout the region. Also, Silos and Smokestacks staff and the other partner sites are knowledgeable in helping you look at what other sites you might want to visit in the region. But really, right now, there are about at least 3 million visitors annually to the region that are traveling to learn more about, not just to learn. They're just here to have fun. You know, one thing is, you know, the heritage area sites, they are about heritage, but they're fun sites. They are interesting. You get to connect with real people living the real life of agriculture.
Do you find that there, and maybe you don't know even, are there people who are planning trips to come to the National Heritage Area, or is this something where people who are in Iowa tend to do this spontaneously, or maybe people who live in an area pick up some of these, you know, brochures or think about these sites in a different way that may be close to their homes?
I think it's all of those. We know that one of the primary visitors to the state of Iowa, as well as the heritage area, is friends and family that are visiting Iowans. They're folks that are coming back, that are coming to visit their family here or friends, and then they're wanting to do things with them. And there are many things they can do in their backyard and right in their own backyard. But we also know that because the National Heritage Area is an affiliated area of the National Park Service, we are also seeing travelers specifically that are National Park Service followers. And they, you know, have their passport and their their list of places they want to visit, they are coming to the Heritage Area. We know this because they are collecting their cancellation stamps, which they call the passport cancellation stamp. And so we have about 16 sites that carry that stamp, and we know those travelers are coming to our region to do just that.
Well, let's find out about some of the new sites, and we'll talk more a little bit later about how you decide who can become a part of the National Heritage Area. And the first new site is the Johnson County Historical Society in Coralville. And with me today is Leanne Randack. She is curator of the Johnson County Historical Society. Hello, Leanne.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And tell me a little bit about the Historical Society. How do you feel the Historical Society tells the story of agriculture in America?
I think we do that in a variety of different ways. We, of course, focus on the history of Johnson County, and so look more specifically at Johnson County's role in agriculture in Iowa. We have a museum in Coralville that has a permanent exhibit about changes in agriculture. Also, a lot of our other exhibits. It's hard to tell the story of Johnson County without weaving agriculture into it. It's such a big part of Johnson County's history. Sometimes we can forget that if we're stay in Iowa City and don't get out to the rural areas. But most of our other exhibits in some way have to bring in the story of agriculture, the story of our farms, in order to tell an individual story. And we also interpret three historic sites that are also part of the silos and smokestacks and that tell different stories of agriculture at each of those different sites, a little bit of a different story. We have the 1876 Coralville Schoolhouse, and that tells the story of rural schools, country schools, which were a huge part of our agricultural history, where rural children went to school for decades. And we also interpret for the state of Iowa Plum Grove Historic Home, which is in Iowa City now, but it was a 360-acre farm very early in the 1840s, part of Iowa agricultural history. And then we interpret for Johnson County the 1855 Asylum Building, which is out at the old county poor farm. Again, this was an operating farm and an institutional farm, so a very different agricultural story.
Well, and I want to talk more about your new permanent exhibit, A Home on the Farm, in just a moment. We're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and talk more about that. I'm talking with Leanne Randack. She is curator of the Johnson County Historical Society of Coralville, a new part of the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area, and also Candy Welch Street, who is program and partnership director of Silos and Smokestacks in Waterloo. Coming up the rest of this hour, we're going to talk about some other new additions to the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area, including Miss Effie's Country Flowers and Garden Stuff in Donahue. We'll find out about the Tyden Farm No. 6 in Doherty, and also the Dysart Historical Center in Dysart. And if you're looking for more information, you can go to our Facebook page. We put up a link to the Silos and Smokestacks website, so you can find out more about the 110 different sites that are included in the National Heritage Area. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. There are four new sites that are now a part of the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area, which covers 37 counties in the northeast quadrant of the state. With me today, Candy Welch Street. She's Program and Partnership Director of Silos and Smokestacks in Waterloo. And Leanne Randack, who is Curator of the Johnson County Historical Society in Coralville, one of the new sites included in Silos and Smokestacks. And one of the things that was cited in selecting the Historical Society to be part of Silos and Smokestacks is your new permanent exhibition called A Home on the Farm. Tell me a little bit about it. What is the focus of the exhibition?
Well, the exhibition really looks at what we wanted to look at was the changing lives of farm families specific. So when we were looking at what story should we tell with this exhibit in terms of agriculture, that's what we decided. And that's there is a huge change in how farm families' lives have changed. And we focused on the latter part of the 20th century, so from 1930 to about 1990. part of that involves technology and how farm work has changed. Part of it involves expansion of urban areas. Part of it is just home technology. I mean, we have a little devoted to the coming of electricity in the 1930s and 40s and how much of a change that brings to living on a farm, but also changes that occur in the 50s and 70s and so forth. And we've tried to do that by taking fictional farm family, really, and kind of incorporating some of the changes so that people, as they come through, can see what happens to that farm family. How do their lives specifically change through time? And we've also incorporated some oral histories that we've done of people who lived on farms, farmers, their children, and so forth in the exhibit as well.
So I'm sure that you get a lot of kids coming through the museum who are interested in this. What kinds of things do you have that can really engage kids and help them understand the changes?
Sure. One of the things, of course, the work that you have to do on the farm from 1930 to today, or the late to the 1990s, has changed immensely in the amount of work you have to do. So one of the things we ask kids to do in the exhibit in the 1930s is kind of explore all the different types of work that they would have to do and that they would be responsible for as well as their parents. And one of the opportunities that they have is to see what it was like to husk corn. So, of course, most farmers in the 1930s in Iowa were still husking corn by hand out in the field, and older children, that would be something that they could help with. There were corn husking contests and so forth, and they would use older farmers will know about corn pegs and other corn huskers, corn hooks used to help husk corn. So we have a perhaps a little less dangerous. The kids don't get to actually use the hooks, but using a substitute, which is Velcro, they get to get the idea of what it's like to put on a corn hook and see how fast they can husk some corn that we have as part of the exhibit.
With the Coralville Schoolhouse, I know you have programs also to get kids involved to help them understand what it was like to go to a rural country school. Can you tell me about some of those programs?
Sure. Our most popular program and the biggest program we have is our Be a Guest of the Past program, and that actually is centered around fifth graders and really gives them an idea of what it was like to go to school. We focus on the 1870s, so an early part of the school's history. They not only spend a whole day in the classroom doing lessons, they have a series of lessons that their teacher does with them before they even come to the school. So they learn about country schools even before they come. They assume a character, somebody who might have lived and went to that school in the 1870s. What would their life be like? They have some opportunities to learn a character background, but also to develop a little bit, but based on what they've learned about their person. And then they come to the school and are that character for the whole day. And what did kids in the 1870s learn? Penmanship, completely different than how kids write today. Learning to write on slates as opposed to other technology or even paper. And also what was discipline like at that time. And also how did the school day affect and was integrated with farm life. So they learn about the fact that older boys often didn't get to go to school during the spring and fall when there was planting and harvesting, and so it may have taken them a little longer to get through school, and how that growing up on a farm affected their schooling and vice versa.
So some wonderful hands-on ways for kids to really understand
Iowa
history.
And it's great to listen to, you know, things that come out of that
sure,
as well.
Sure, absolutely. So what made you or people involved with the Historical Society want to be a part of Silos and Smokestacks?
Well, there's numerous reasons, and we've wanted to a long time, and this exhibit is kind of in the museum as was kind of a push to get us to do that. I mean, just the idea of a connected network of all sorts of sites that tell the story of agriculture. I mean, Silos and Smokestacks is a wonderful support giving programs and workshops on topics that are relevant to us and what we need as an institution, but also their help in promoting our site along with all the other sites, promoting programs that we have. They have numerous grant opportunities as well that are important to us. So those are just a few of the reasons that being part of that network and being part of a national network, I mean, really, this is something with a national connection, was really important and exciting to us.
Leanne Rondock is curator of the Johnson County Historical Society in Coralville, a new member of Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Areas. Thank you so much, Leanne.
Yes, you're welcome.
Candy, you must get a lot of applications from sites around this part of the state that want to be a part of Silos and Smokestacks. How many do you incorporate every year? How do you decide?
That's a great question. Actually, you know, when I was thinking back, when you asked us to come talk a little bit about what the Heritage Area does and the new sites, that made me think back. I've been with the organization now for quite a few years. I was pretty green when I got started in the heritage development work. And 2001, there were only 9 partner sites. And now, 2010, there are 110. And we've really taken an approach to working with the communities and sites. You know, anybody in the heritage area that wants to be a part of the heritage area and be listed in the visitor guide and be open to the public can. But we really start a process, not just you apply and you're either in or you're out, but more of a process for creating a long-term relationship with the site to help them build the capacity for them to tell their own stories and tell them the best that they can. And so really, we do have an application process that's ongoing, but it's a process that we have folks, we work with emerging sites. So right now, I think we have like approximately 14 emerging sites that are working to develop their interpretation, to develop their educational programming, to develop their visitor experience. They have a story, but they're not actively interpreting it to the public yet. And so, you know, each year I would anticipate that we're going to see, you know, maybe 4 to 6. It just depends from year to year as these communities, you know, we're working together, but all the resources don't come together immediately. So it takes a little time. And so really, if anyone's interested in becoming a partner site or working to explore that, they just need to give Silos and Smokestacks staff a call or drop us an email. And it's just as simple as that. And a lot of times those conversations happen around a kitchen table. Really, you know, or a little boardroom table. It just starts with that little a desire that they want to preserve their agricultural heritage.
Well, and Leanne gave us a little bit of an idea of this, but when a site becomes a Silos and Smokestacks site, what are the benefits to that site? What changes?
You bet. Actually, the biggest one is becoming a part of a larger network. You can imagine a small community, the benefits may be different than that of a large historical site or a large attraction. They get some additional marketing and awareness about their site that they may not have been able to do alone. Obviously, travelers don't look at boundaries. They look at experiences. And so being a part of an experience, an agricultural heritage experience, they're immediately thrown into a larger pool of potential visitors. So that's one thing. Also, we really try to provide both technical, and what I mean by that is Silos and Smokestacks staff, the other partner sites, are a great resource to, if they're working on a project, to get advice, to get expertise and knowledge in how to do something and to do it the best that they can and learn from other people's, you know, battle wounds, if you will. And so also we provide some seed money to do the work, because it takes resources, and we provide matching funds for them to do that work.
Well, let's find out about another one of the new sites that are a part of the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. Kathy LaFrenz is the owner of Miss Effie's Country Flowers and Garden Stuff in Donahue, one of the new sites. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being with us today. So if we visit Miss Effie's Country Flowers, what do we find there?
Well, we are a very small site. We are a privately owned farm, and I, 10 years ago, planted a 20-by-20 patch of U-pick flowers, and now we're up to an acre of U-pick flowers, and we have developed our farm to be a place that reflects women's role in agriculture and the history of women's role in agriculture.
So how did you do that? How did you design your farm to show visitors that?
I think part of it came from my relationship with my own grandmother, who essentially saved the family farm during the Depression by selling baked goods and eggs and chickens and butter and cream and sending her daughters out on horseback. So I had that history in me. Now we have a large flock of chickens, and they're heritage breed chickens. And, you know, it's fun to show the kids the green eggs and the brown eggs and a few of the white eggs. And I use a lot of things that women might have done in the 30s and 40s, but I do it differently. Women during that time period would quilt. Well, I'm not a quilter, but I can paint quilt blocks for my barns. And women appreciated their pretty china, even though they didn't have a lot of it. So I have a teacup tree that we've tied 125 antique teacups to that sits out in my gardens. We do a lot of canning here on the farm, so it's not unusual for a visitor to come and I say, hey, I've got a pot of salsa on. I'm going to have to run back into the house. So that's what we do. We do it very hands-on. It's our lifestyle, and we just show it that way.
So when people visit the farm, I mean, you're a U-Pick flower farm, so obviously they're coming there. They're attracted by the flowers. But with these other things around, do you also try to incorporate some education, or is this an opportunity to just to enjoy and appreciate some of the older things?
I do teach classes here on a fairly regular basis. We do canning classes, cheese making classes. I have some friends that do art classes. Instead of having quilting bees here, we have knitting days here where people can learn how to knit, learn how to spin, process some fiber by hand. I teach a lot of bread baking classes. And so those are on our schedule on a regular basis. We also do cider pressing in the fall with children. So that's a very hands-on process that they have.
Having been inspired by your grandmother, do you think about her a lot?
Yeah, I do. We just lost her a few years ago, so she was almost 100.
Oh, wow.
And so we had a lot of great stories.
And does the thought of her, does that change how you act on a daily basis? Is she with you that constantly?
Pretty much, because my house is filled with a lot of her furniture and pieces from her home. And she was one wonderful cook. And so that's a great inspiration, too.
I'll bet you hear from a lot of visitors who see these things and think about their own grandparents.
It's pretty funny. A few years ago, my own washer and dryer broke down, and I couldn't get parts for 3 weeks. So I had a friend that loaned me an old Ringer wash machine, and I had never used one growing up at all. So instead of bringing a Ringer wash machine into the house and hooking it up, I just ran it outside and ran the hose to it and did my laundry that way. And it was so funny because people are going, oh, my gosh, I have not seen one of these, you know, and told stories about catching their hands in it. And so even every so often on a nice day, I'll bring it out and do my laundry with it.
It's funny what people can really connect with, isn't it?
It is. It is. And even hanging clothes out on the clothesline. You know, one time one of my customers called that the old-fashioned dryer.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kathy,
bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Kathy LaFrenz is the owner of Miss Effie's Country Flowers and Garden Stuff in Donahue, one of the new sites that is now a part of Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. And Candy, before we go to the break, we have just a minute. We have just demonstrated that Silos and Smokestacks is a combination of very different places. I mean, here we're talking about a small rural business as opposed to a historical museum. as you incorporate areas, is there an effort to balance out some of the more entrepreneurial ideas with the more historic sites?
Absolutely. I just can't help but chuckle when I hear Kathy talk about what they do there. She just inspires me, like her grandmother did, but she is an inspiring person. And so it takes all kinds of places to share our stories, because there are so many to be told. And also, us as visitors, we like various things. You know, I refer to them as streakers, strollers, and studiers. Some of us will go to every historic site and read and every site, every exhibit they have. But other times, you can take my family. My husband will read everything, but then you've got my 12-year-old that's going to fly through there. So you need different experiences to connect with people. And so each one has a unique story and a unique way of sharing it. And there's no one right way to do it. And so it just is very inspiring to me. I mean, Kathy even has a blog that she reports on her stories and her daily life. So she's connecting with people in a different way. So, and those classes, what a great way to hands-on a lost art, you know, of canning and these traditions that we don't have an opportunity to do.
I'm talking with Candy Welch-Street. She's Program and Partnership Director of Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. We've been talking about some of the new sites that are now a part of the National Heritage Area, and we'll find out about a couple more in just a moment. Titan Farm Number 6 in Doherty and the Dysart Historical Center. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about some new additions to the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. The National Heritage Area was founded in 1996. It covers 37 counties in the northeastern quadrant of the state. It's bordered roughly by Interstates 80 and 35 and includes 110 different sites that work together to tell the story about American agriculture. And we're going to talk about one of the newer sites. Again, this is Titan Farm Number 6 in Doherty, and Ted Pitzenberger is co-owner of the farm. Hello, Ted.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And I think before we talk about the farm, we need to talk about Enel Titan, because this is a name that I get the impression we all should know, but most of us don't know very much about him. Tell me who Enel Titan was.
Emil Titan was a Swedish immigrant that came to the U.S. in 1865 with $20 in his pocket, and he did various jobs, ended up in Chicago and working for the railroad in the later 1800s, and he was an immigrant agent, and he was around trains a lot, and one of his first inventions was how to seal the trains. They were done with a lead press and cables and stuff, and he came up with a band that he patented in 1895, and was formerly known as the Titan Boxcar Seal. And that was one of his first inventions. And anyway, from that, he had numerous other inventions, and was one of our country's, we feel, one of our country's unsung inventors.
Well, yeah, he had, 200 patents in his lifetime?
Close to 200 patents in his lifetime. He died in 1951.
What were some of the other things, if you can think of them, that
he
patented?
He did a table lock. The old table locks at the turn of the century where the round pedestal tables would sag in the middle, he invented a lock that would hold them straight, was one of his patents. He got into the fire sprinkler business after one of his factories burnt down, and had all new patents, and a lot of his patents are within that industry there.
Well, and I've seen an image of this this sprinkler mechanism that he worked on, and it looks very much like what we see on the sprinklers that are mounted on the walls of industrial sites or public buildings today.
That's correct. The family business is still the Viking Corporation. They're number two in the world for sprinkler systems.
And he had how many factories?
He had the Hastings Piston and Ring he helped start up in Hastings, Michigan. His nephew ran that. They had the Titan Seal in Hastings, Michigan. The Viking Corporation is still in headquarters out of Hastings, Michigan yet. And he did all his manufacturing in Hastings.
Well, and he really was at the forefront of mass production as well, wasn't he?
That's right. When they started the seal business, they had to start that at full business at full speed, and that took a huge amount of money to get that set up, and they bought out a press factory in Chicago and moved that to Hastings to make all the machines to make these seals.
So how did he come to Iowa? What was his relationship to the state?
That we don't know.
Okay.
We don't know. He was traveling through. We don't know what brought him to Iowa. And he built eight farms around here. He bought first two in 1915, and then he came in the early part of the Depression. And from 32 to 39, he bought and built six more farms. And ours is number six of the farms. He established it, bought it in 35, and built everything in 36 here.
So what was his goal with these farms?
His goal with the farms,
mm-hmm.
from what we can tell, it was to build the most efficient farms that he could build. They were big. They were show places. He employed a lot of people, and he felt he was doing it right when he was doing it. He worked, got a lot of information from Iowa State and followed a lot of their stuff, and he was on the forefront of agriculture in the 30s.
And he grew a lot of potatoes on these farms, I also understand.
No, not on these. When he was with the railroad, he got immigrants to move to Idaho.
Okay.
And there is a story about the lore has it that he's one of the fathers of the great Idaho potato.
Okay. So
how it got started here in Chicago and went east.
This farm, Titan Farm Number 6, what do visitors find when they come to your farm?
They found there's a big set of buildings that were built here in 1936 that are pretty much exactly as they were then. There's a huge cement corn crib here that was state-of-the-art when it was built in 36. It had its own elevator inside, overhead storage for 10,000 bushel, and it held about 14,000 bushel of eared corn on each, 7,000 on each side of it. It had its own hoist inside. The barn is 40 by 140 with an L-shaped 36 by 140 cattle shed off the back of that. They fed a lot of beef cattle here.
And you're still working the farm today?
Yes, yes.
So how do you incorporate welcoming visitors into your working farm?
We're trying to schedule tours during the summer months here, in July and August mainly, and we're trying to do group tours that will consist up to 40 people.
Okay.
And we show them the history of the farm. We have a 20-minute documentary we show. We show the construction of all the buildings. We can walk into them. The whole barn is becoming a museum. We have the front part of the barn is a house museum of a lot of house memorabilia and antiques that we have here, and the back two-thirds of the barn, or three-fourths, is antique farm machinery that we have. We've been able to, so far, to buy stuff with history that we know the original owners, where it came from. We have quite a bit of 20s and 30s equipment that actually works yet.
Wow. Well, this sounds like a real labor of love for you, Ted.
Yeah, it is. Especially, my wife is the spark plug behind this that really has did a lot of groundwork on it, and I get to tag along and buy the antiques and stuff.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Ted Pitzenberger is co-owner of Titan Farm Number 6 in Doherty, one of the new sites that is now a part of the National Heritage Area, Silos and Smokestacks. And now to our fourth site today, the Dysart Historical Center. In Dysart, hello, Catherine Wick. How are you today?
Good morning. Just fine, thank you, in the snowstorm.
Yes. Well, January finally arrived, didn't
yep.
it? So tell me about the Dysart Historical Center. When people visit, what do they find?
Well, they find three buildings. The first is our historical museum, which was founded in 1997 when we were given a small brick church. It is 118 years old this year, and we've completely restored it top to bottom. And then in 2003, we moved in a Tama County Rural School and restored it. This was opened in 2007 when we finished our work. And now we have a new agricultural museum and interpretive center, which our grand opening was in October. And, of course, we're definitely a project in progress because we have a lot of work to do on displays. And, of course, this will always be ongoing. But
congratulations. It sounds like you've really gotten a lot done just in the very recent history.
Yes, we have. We have a lot of great volunteers, and everybody has worked very hard. And it's really coming along.
So when you visit the new museum, what do people find there?
Well, in the historical museum, just as the name implies, we have a lot of things from our past. And with the new emphasis that we've learned about and how to do it, we're trying to, from our silos and smokestacks facilitators, we're trying to tell more and more the stories of the things that we have in there. For instance, our displays from the World Wars, such things as our muskets and things like that. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do in that building. In our country school, we have the history of rural education and the history of that particular school, which has been wonderfully documented by the people who went there. And then, of course, in our new building, we're trying to tell the story of the agricultural activities and advancements in our own area. And we've come up with what we think is kind of a neat slogan for our building. We've called it Iowa Agriculture, a Growing Experience. And our aim is to treasure the past and teach for the future. And we have a lot of things. I think the oldest item we have goes back to about 1850. And we have neat stories to go with them. Those are some of the things they're going to see. For tour groups, we do have some videos, one that our students made, which is called The Ties That Bind, has a lot in it from our senior citizens, many of whom are no longer with us, telling about farm life, early education. And then we also have a video that was done by a prize-winning project for the orphan trains, and that is another one of our big emphases in our displays is the orphan trains. It's such an important part of our heritage and is related to agriculture, too.
Did you have a lot of the orphan trains brought children, orphans, west from the East Coast when there were not people to take care of them there? Did you have a lot of settlers in Dysart that came these?
We had one family that came with five children, and they all were kept in this community and grew up here, and many of their descendants are still here, good citizens of our community. And we think it's important in its relationship to agriculture because, you know, back then, children were a real asset on the farm, and that's why a lot of them were taken off the train and given homes so that they could work on the farms.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Dysart. What makes your town special?
Well, I think probably what makes it the most special is the number of volunteers we have. We always say that Dysart runs on volunteers, and our historical society certainly does. That's how we get things done, is we have no paid employees. And volunteerism, and the other thing is cooperation and enthusiasm.
As you're opening this new museum, and clearly you have a lot of enthusiasm about the future, but you were hit very hard by that big windstorm last year, weren't you?
Yes, we were. We're still feeling the effects of it. I noticed this week downtown they're finally getting a couple of the roofs that weren't done yet. They're getting them underway to be repaired, and we're still working on the damage to our trees. We have all the old trees down, and we're in the process now of taking out the stumps and so forth. but we've had a big, big job. The color appropriate for this summer in Dysart was blue roof.
Well, I'm sure that must have been very difficult. And as you saw that devastation and some of those stately old trees come down, did it change how you feel about the work that you're doing to preserve the history of Dysart?
Well, I would say that it did. I think we are even more appreciative of what we have. We did sustain about $3,000 worth of damage at our historical center, and it has even become more precious to us, I think.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Catherine.
Well, you are welcome. It was a pleasure to share our project with you.
I really appreciate it. Catherine Wick of the Dysart Historical Center, one of the latest additions to the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. And we have just a couple of minutes left. With me still is Candy Welch, Street Program and Partnership Director of Silos and Smokestacks. And Candy, we did get a question from one of our listeners today who's curious about how Silos and Smokestacks operates. Kurt in Urbandale is wondering what your annual budget is, and how do you decide how to spend that money?
Well, that's a good question. Well, we are a nonprofit organization that holds a cooperative agreement with the National Park Service, and because of our federal designation as the coordinating entity, we are eligible for matching funds through our legislation, and so we are eligible to receive up to $1 million a year in federal funding. That federal funding is set to sunset here in 2012, actually. That doesn't mean the federal designation of this region would go away. That will always be the case. This region will always be recognized as a special place. But the funding for the coordinating entity could. We are currently working extending the funding for that with our congressional delegation as well as with the Alliance of National Heritage Areas, because we're not the only national heritage area with a sunsetting date. The idea was that let me step back and say that up to this point, as you can imagine, with the federal budget, we've never reached our full appropriations. But we are required by law to provide a one-to-one non-federal match to each dollar we receive. And so a lot of that comes in the way of matching through the matching grants. So our budget, I would say roughly most of that money goes into programs is probably around $700,000 or so.
Do you feel like the Silos and Smokestacks area, we've talked about how large it is, 37 counties, and it has grown a lot in the time since it was founded. Do you see that expanding in future years?
Do I see the boundaries expanding?
Right.
Well, that has definitely surfaced a few times because across the nation, folks are seeing the value that the heritage area designation can have in their community. We certainly get calls from other counties outside the heritage area in the state of Iowa. We've also been asked by the state of Wisconsin and Iowa. But right now it would take a congressional act of Congress. I guess it would take an act of Congress to change that. So I don't see it happening too soon.
Well, Candy, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you, Charity. Really enjoyed it.
Candy Welch Street is Program and Partnership Director of the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area. If you'd like to find out more about it and some of the new additions, you can go to the website, which is silosandsmokestacks.org. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support came from Phil Moss in Cedar Falls. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with young adult author Catherine Erskine. Talk of Iowa was a production of IPR.